You will search for a long time, and you will not find it profitable to try to find a better example of leadership than when the Lord gathered his 12 and sent them to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, telling them to proclaim as they go that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Leadership. Understand that we throw that term around sometimes but poorly define it. Leadership is the learned skill of developing people to work together as a group in coordinated efforts that achieve a common objective. That is a lofty assignment for anyone. And Jesus did it perfectly. And that's probably why whenever you read books written on the subject in the world, the business world, the educational world, whatever realm you're in, you find the same principle over and over. Well, that shouldn't surprise us. We'll be studying from Matthew 10 extensively today if you want to turn over there. And even in that passage, the Lord himself, when he sends his 12 out, he says, when you go into the world, I need you to be wise as serpents, but harmless or innocent as doves. Now, what did he mean there? Well, here's what I want us to learn from that. If these principles resonate in the hearts of the serpents, the worldly leaders and people who have no interest in serving God whatsoever, I submit to you they will be remarkably helpful to God's leaders, the doves. And for that reason, we're going to take Matthew 10 and we're going to look at it in a snapshot to make some observations about Jesus as a leader. And then we're going to consider some difficult questions. Difficult questions that God's leaders must ask of themselves. So let's begin with some observations about Jesus, the leader. Notice in the first place that what Jesus did was he conducted an honest assessment, and then he assembled a team to address a huge problem. That's verse 1 of Matthew 10. He called to him his 12 disciples, and he gave them authority over the unclean spirits to cast them out, to heal every disease and every affliction. Jesus performed an assessment, and he assembled a team for a huge problem. The scale of it was even too big for the Lord himself. He identified the objective. The objective is in verse number 6. There are lost sheep in the house of Israel. That's his objective. Everything that follows revolves around that singular word, the objective. There are lost. And that problem was of such scale that not even the Son of God took it on by himself. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us something about Jesus and his approach to leadership. But in the second place, Jesus empowered that team. He didn't just assemble them. He didn't just give them titles. He empowered them by transferring ownership through delegation. He transferred ownership. Now, Tim Elmore is one of my preferred writers. He defines delegation as an equal part of responsibility and autonomy. A 50-50 proposition, and I kind of like that. And you see how Jesus is the great delegator. You see it in verses 5 through 7. And notice as we breeze through this passage how he does it. In the first place, he sets very clear expectations with defined boundaries. Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans. A very defined boundary. Here's your limit. But in the second place, he emphasized the primary objective. As you go, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Their objective are the lost people. But he has one major activity for them to do. Everything they did was to be revolving around one singular activity. proclaim as you go, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Within those parameters, however, the individual team members could do what they want. He didn't tell them what specific town to go to. He didn't tell them what specific disease or class of individuals struggling with those diseases to work with. He didn't tell them exactly what house to stay in. He didn't tell them precisely how long to stay there. He left those details up to them. They were within a set of parameters, and he said, now go do it. And that's artful delegation, something that we tend to struggle with as human beings. But to keep them in the same direction, harnessed on that kingdom announcement activity, Jesus required them to use a consistent plan. That's verses 8 through 11. And if we really break down that text, we're going to see several required elements that Jesus expected his team to follow. The first element was completely physical. What were they going to do? You're going to heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. A very clear physical plan. How are we going to, what actions are we going to perform? But he also says there's a financial element of a well-made plan. Now here it's somewhat ironic because he says, you received without paying, so give without pay. But that's a financial calculation that goes into the act of this mission that he sends them on. He moves from the financial element to the material element, the resource allocation. And here again, we get a little touch of irony because here they're really not to have any resources. Their success is to be committed to God. But he tells them, acquire no gold or silver or copper for your belts, no bag for your journey or two tunics or sandals or staff. Labor deserved material allocation. He moves there to the idea of personal commitment. If you're going to be a member of Jesus' team, you're going to work and you're going to step up to the plate and you're going to be bought in. And we see it. Because he tells them in verse 11, whatever town or village you enter, find out who's worthy and stay there. In other words, don't you expect comfort on this trip. This is all about what you're going to do, not about what you're going to receive. This is completely up to you. No expectation of comfort. You rely solely on the kindness of the people you interact with. But it was also measurable. And we know that because he said, until you depart, implying you monitor your success, and when the reception runs low, it's time for you to leave. It's interesting, a consistent plan. But despite that, and kind of hinted in what we just saw, Jesus didn't just give them a plan and say, now beat this plan to death. What he really told them was, I expect for you to be prudent enough and committed enough to the mission we are on to make real-time modifications as necessary based on result. That's verses 12 through 15. Specifically, we could look at verse 14. If anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that. Modifications are required. Let's look at another one. Fourth thing he did. He prevented distraction. He prevented distraction among his team by causing them to appreciate they were not to seek personal, physical satisfaction. The reality is if they were to focus on anything other than mission success, they would quickly become uncommitted because Jesus wants them to know they're going to experience several unsatisfying situations. Discomfort and unsatisfying situations were the expectation of what was going to happen. So look what he tells them is going to happen. You're going to have interpersonal problems. You're going to be sheep in the midst of wolves. You're going to have legal problems because they're going to take you before courts. You're going to have religious problems because they're going to beat you in their synagogue. You're going to have civil problems too. They're going to take you before kings and governors. That's a whole lot of uncomfort, unsatisfying situations. And if you're serving the Lord because it gives you some sense or position of satisfaction, what He wants them to know is very quickly you're going to run out of gas. So endure it. And to do that, verses 19 through 22, He tells them, I want you to receive strength. I want you to rely, Matthew 10, upon your strength. That strength will come from the words of the Spirit, and it will come from your hope of heaven. But the pathway that you take, strength by itself doesn't help. There's a pathway that He gives. You need a pathway whenever you're enduring these conflicts. Yeah, I want you to have the strength of the resource of God's Word and of the hope that you have in front of you. I want that to strengthen you, but I also want you to rely upon a path out. And He takes them back to their detailed plan. Look at verse 23 of Matthew 10. When they persecute you in one town, flee to the next. For I say to you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Appreciate that's not just a random statement. We can infer from that within their planning, they had done two other things. One was they had established contingencies. If this doesn't work and this isn't working promptly, we're going to leave. And we're not going to wait and say, now, where do we go now? We have plan A, city B, village C, D, E, all the way down. We know our contingencies. But He also says you have a timeline. Because you won't have gone through everything you wanted to do before the Son of Man comes right on your heels. So you're under time restraints here. You have a boundary of time. So very specific plan, but don't you become distracted. Number five, Jesus motivated His team with deeply serious spiritual realities. Deeply serious spiritual priorities. Every step they took, every action they performed was to reflect their master. How would they do that? Verses 26 through 33. You fear Him who can destroy soul and body in hell and not your opponent. How would they want to do that? Verses 29 through 31. You find your value in how God assesses you, not how people around you assess you. Thirdly, verses 32 through 39, you seek spiritual reward, being acknowledged before my Father in heaven, which, by the way, is the context of that statement. That statement, strictly speaking, is not about conversion. It's about the fruits of work. But He says, you're going to be acknowledged before my Father. I want you to pursue that, not physical fulfillment. And in the process, verses 40 through 42, He identifies what are probably the two most common sources of distraction from the Lord's work. The first of these, verse 34 through 36, a confused objective. Do not think, the Lord said, that I have come to bring peace on earth. I don't know how that hits you. That's not sometimes how we view Christianity or the Lord's work, particularly in the month of December when you start getting cards in the mail. Jesus explicitly says, I did not come to bring peace on in among the earth. That's not why I'm here. And if you begin to think that that's why I'm here, you're going to get off track from the mission, the job I'm giving you to do. Now, He doesn't say, I want you to go out and start fights. What he says is, I want you to do what my real objective is, and that is to restore peace between human beings on earth and the God of heaven. That's your objective. That's what you're about. That's what I came to do. You are my servants. I am your master. You are my disciples. I am your teacher. Now go do likewise. Everything they did. Now, the corollary to that, perhaps, or the second most common problem, is lack of buy-in. 37 through 39 is a jaw-dropper. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses it for my sake will find it. Lack of commitment. Quickly, five brief, only five, there are more, principles of leadership that Jesus just shows vividly in Matthew chapter 10. But now let's take those five ideas and consider there are some difficult choices that God's leaders have to make to lead like Jesus. Difficult choice number one. Will we as God's leaders be decision makers? Or will we be disciple makers? Will we as God's leaders be decision makers or disciple makers? I don't know how it is where you're from. I know how it's like where I'm from and other places I've visited, other places I've been. It seems to me that almost universally when a public prayer is led, and they should be, and we're grateful for those who serve as shepherds, but almost universally, the spirit of the prayer is, Lord, help guide our elders in their decisions that they make. Because we have created a culture, an expectation of the Lord's church that what elders do is sit in boards room and make decisions. We want to know what paint color is. We want to know who's going to be our internet service provider. We want to know who's going to be on the insurance. We want to know, and we sit in the room and we make decisions. All right. We know, I believe, 1 Peter 5, the first two verses, Acts chapter 20, verse 28, you can't be an overseer without making decisions. It is inherent in the job. It's job description. It's in it. But here's the point. We need shepherds to do a lot more than make decisions. Willinkin Babeen phrased it this way. Leaders, in their words, face the facts through honest assessment of themselves and their team's performance. So on that light, I don't want us to target this toward ourselves or any specific eldership or even anything like that. I want us to think broadly. The Lord established one major objective for His followers in Matthew 28, verse 19. Did He not? Go into all the world. Job number one, exclusive mission, what I need you, want you, and commissioning you to do with the authority of God in heaven is make disciples. Now, let's do what our authors recommended and just consider some facts. Nationwide, how are we doing? Well, let's look at two variables. Let's look at population statistics, and we could quote a number of references here. We'll take an article that was written outside of our fellowship in the year 2021 in Christian Standard. The author was Kent Fillinger. He noted the six-year period between when he wrote in 2015, congregations of the churches of Christ have lost in that six-year period 2,000 members and 9 congregations every month. And checking that statistic from some other sources, pretty well spot on. How are we doing in disciple making? I mean, statistics aren't everything. But notice his numbers included times before the pandemic. Now, okay, so let's look at another one. Well, that's people outside the world, and we live in a different time, a different culture. It's a lot harder to reach people today than it was. Well, that's what we like to think. But, you know, it's hard. And it is. Well, let's think about the kids that grow up in our churches. Nationwide, how are we doing with that one? You won't find a reliable statistic that does not say we lose the overwhelming majority of the kids who grow up in our churches. I just ask us the hard question, are we disciple making? Not to be mean about it, but just to say, let's take a step back and look. How are we doing? If we're going to improve those metrics, I believe we need to create a spirit that is less about the boardroom where decisions are made to directing an all hands on deck effort to make disciples. Make the decisions in 10 minutes and then spend the next 3 hours disciple making. And I think that's the goal. But I thought so hard my hair fell out. So, you know, I consider it. Are we going to be disciple makers or decision makers? That's a hard choice. Related to that, hard decision number two. Will we cultivate apathy or will we delegate authority? Will we cultivate apathy or will we delegate authority? Executive leaders in anything have to delegate authority to secondary leaders. And that's true everywhere. In our situation, that would be elders to deacons, I believe, biblically, Acts 6 and some other places, delegating authority. The reason we need to do that is if we do not have a large base of authority with many access points for various members, all of our members, to engage in the work, they become very content with where we, by design of how we've organized our churches, currently are, and that's on the sidelines. And after you stay on the sidelines for a while, you know what happens? You become comfortable. And if you get comfortable there, that's just like a baby step away from outright apathy. The solution to that is you have to create multiple independently operating, but under the oversight of the eldership, access points for as many people as you can do. And 2 men, 3 men, 4 men, 6 men, 12 men, a 20-man eldership can't do that for a congregation. At best, they can hit 5 or 6 as each individual. So many access points. But when we draw members in, they do more, they learn more, they innovate more, they reach more, and they stay more. Will we cultivate apathy or will we delegate authority to unharness the power of our body? Difficult choice number 3. Will we be pleased with effort or will we pursue excellence? Will we be pleased with effort or will we pursue excellence? A hard question. Looking at Jesus' example, it seems pretty clear to me that just selecting a team and delegating authority to them does not accomplish the mission. There's more. Measurable results are the only way we can make a distinction between doing something and doing the right things. The only way you tell if you're on the right course in anything is what are the results, right? If you travel here, and you wind up off course, you kind of know you made a wrong choice. Somewhere along the way, things are off. Oh. Secondary leaders accomplish this with a detailed plan. We talked about some of the principles of those, the physical, logistical, financial, the commitment that they make to it, to actually perform the work. We talked about measurable goals that are used to lead us through the situation. Excellence is going to require that we actually get serious about having committed templates of planning for our local ministry that are stuck to, that are modifiable, that react to the situations at hand, because we need to improve it. We do better making disciples. And you may not. Congregation might be thriving, and I pray that it is. But nationally, we've got an opportunity. Choice number four. Will we define success by what brings us pleasure or by what we can measure? Will we define success by what brings us pleasure or by what we can measure? Here we are again, measurable results, outcomes. What's happening? What's happening with our teenagers? What's happening to our conversion trends? What's happening? And all those are important variables. Here's some that don't matter. Survival. We exist, therefore we're on the right path. Other congregations have closed their doors, we haven't. That's a pretty low bar. Survival's not the key. You're not on a good path because you survived. You might be the last church standing, right? Well, how about this one? We have people with titles. We have positions. Therefore, we are maturing. We have elders. We have deacons. And thank the Lord for that. We have ministers. We have what have you. You start running down that list. We have people in positions. Therefore, we are maturing. Well, maybe. Hopefully. How about that? We have numbers. We have large attendance or budgets or a big building. We have lots of events. We have lots of teens. We have lots of ministries. We have number. Well, but okay. That doesn't really get it. How about comfort? We have experience with several things that we've done for a very long time. We're knowledgeable about them. We've always done it this way. We like it. Conformity. Well, this is what all the other good churches are doing. Regardless of how we feel about it, and all those things really are good to look at, and they're helpful. But we can't be driven by them because the mission suffers if anything but measurable results are what's evaluated. It boils down to this: if it ain't fixed, break it. If it ain't fixed, break. Number five, will we celebrate frivolities or will we concentrate on top priorities? Are we going to celebrate frivolous things or are we going to concentrate on what really matters? Now, Jesus motivated his team not by how much fun they were going to have as they journeyed along, as they sat in their planning meetings, as they stayed in people's homes and ate at the kindness of strangers. Now, all those things are important, but he didn't use those to motivate them. What he used to motivate them was that there are really serious spiritual objectives here, and if you fail at this, they're going to still be lost souls in the house of Israel. That's the motivation, and he, in his instructions that he provides, 24 through 42, he reveals some priorities that we can use. Number one is you engage every member because everyone, verse 31, is valuable. 1 Corinthians 12, 22, the members that seem to be weaker are indispensable, the English Standard says. So every member has a place at the party. In fact, we would do more in this man's judgment if we relied less on professionals and more on our members. And we also, by Jesus' application, we'll accomplish more if we focus on the smaller details, like even the cup of water. So it's interesting sometimes, but nevertheless, every member matters. Number two, use results to guide your decisions and your changes. That was the kind of the spirit of if they don't receive you, leave town. We have to use mentoring as the fundamental element of faith development. One-on-one relationships, that's verse 42. We need to avoid the trap of the distinct group and living there. the youth, the seniors, all having their own little thing. Mentoring has to happen. You got to get people together for that to work. So create multiple opportunities with diverse members working together. The point is, let's move on from secondary things. Try to purposely, with intention, move from some secondary things and emphasize those spiritual priorities. And let those other, they're beautiful. Fun, fellowship, comfort, peace. All of those things are essential in the Lord's plan, I believe, for developing disciples. But let that happen organically. Because sometimes we sit around trying to think, how are we going to create fellowship? And we forget we need to be working on more serious spiritual priorities. But if we change how we work and get 85 people working together on that spiritual priority, a funny thing happens. They begin to enjoy fellowship together. And they begin to enjoy comfort and build relationships. And the things we've tried so hard to create by manufacturing become much more powerful when they happen organically, when people just work together. The other things have the role, and please, I don't mean to imply they don't. They're wonderful things. But the heaven or hell priorities are what matters. Let's conclude with this. Every congregation has a limited commission. Because every congregation is in its own little geographic area of town, of the state, even of the nation. Every congregation has a limited commission. If we just look objectively, it would seem that nationwide, the Lord's church has some areas where improvement's needed in disciple making. And I think we can recognize that. So let's use leadership to move some of those standards, honest assessment, delegating authority, and demanding urgent modification when results aren't there. Let's choose the work of discipleship. Choose it. Engage every member. And let's go about the process of being wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And that's my earnest prayer. There's something in that that at least incites a helpful thought to you and your work. And may you be blessed richly. Thank you very much.